May it please the court. My name is Michael Slidell, registration number 14376. I represent Douglas Demos, the appellant in this matter. Your Honors, in this case, in this trial, the only issue was ZY's credibility. However, the jury's ability to fairly assess the issue was compromised by evidence that improperly bolstered ZY's credibility. That happened in two ways. The first was the character evidence of ZY's truthfulness, and the second was Ms. McDonald, the forensic interviewer's improper comments concerning ZY's credibility. And I think together, they obviously affected the verdict in this case. I'd like to start with the first issue, character. When we talk about somebody's character, we talk about the abiding and stable set of personal qualities that underlie their behavior. We don't define a person's character by a single act or by their behavior in a single circumstance. We recognize that behavior can be out of character. And so Rule 608A, the portion of it that we're concerned with today, is phrased specifically in terms of character. It's not phrased in terms of general credibility, but the much narrower concept of character. And because it's phrased in terms of character, it refers to the abiding moral or ethical qualities of a person. That's what must be attacked to trigger the right to introduce rebuttal character evidence for truthfulness. Credibility is a much broader term. It can include character, but more often it includes and means the believability of testimony on a specific occasion based on the facts of the case and not on the personal qualities of the witness. When that happens, the rule is not true. An attack based on the facts of the case must be answered with the facts of the case, not with testimony concerning character. And so, as the case law points out, relying on inconsistencies or contradictory evidence to impeach a witness is not an attack on character because it is based on the facts of the case.
Well, Mr. Zweibel, can you please address the language from People versus Miller that says whether evidence in the form of contradiction is an attack on the character of the witness must depend upon the circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, obviously that's fairly broad, but what I can tell you is that the federal evidence, the federal cases on which Miller relies, and which I cited in the brief, make it very clear that contradiction is not character evidence. I'm not sure what circumstance, and I can't hypothetically imagine what circumstance, simply introducing contradictory evidence, in what circumstance simply introducing that kind of evidence would constitute an attack on character.
Well, we also have People versus X-Line from another division of this court that indicated that where the defendant's theory of the case was that the alleged victim was not credible and that the alleged sexual assault did not occur, it was apparent that the victim's character for truth and veracity had been attacked.
Your Honor, as I pointed out in the brief, and I'm happy to say it again, X-Line is an outlier. X-Line is wrongly decided. It's really that simple. When you look at, I believe X-Line was even decided before Miller. But when you look at Miller, when you look at the federal authorities in which Miller relied, when you look at People versus Hall, when you look at Wright and Gold, federal practice and procedure that summarizes all of the authorities, it's clear that X-Line is an outlier. I know that X-Line also was criticized on a different issue by the federal district court on habeas. But on this particular issue, I think it was simply wrong because it equates, specifically the theory in X-Line, was that the victim was suggestible and had adopted the suggestions of adults who were questioning or interviewing her or surrounded her. And they said that constituted an attack on character. And I think that's clearly wrong.
Would one have to phrase the question in order to have it be an attack on the character for credibility? Would you have to phrase the question to the witness as, you know, would the questions have had to come out with respect to character? Would that term have to have been used in the questions in order to allow this evidence in your view?
Well, obviously, there's a number of ways it can be phrased, but I think in essence, what it would have to do is refer to the habitual and abiding qualities of the witness. And let me give a couple of examples. In People versus Kuhn, the door was open to this kind of evidence because the victim was called, and I'm quoting, an habitual liar. In Ross, the victim was called, and I quote, an untruthful person. So you have to be referring to the person and to their qualities. In X-Line, when we're talking about suggestibility, I want to talk about that because that was the defendant's theory. The defendant's theory here was that ZYs had adopted false beliefs as a result of suggestion, that she honestly believed those false beliefs, but that her story was inconsistent and incredible because it was, in fact, not true. The defense was not saying that ZY was a liar or an untruthful person. In fact, they said the opposite. In closing, defense counsel said, quote, no one in this courtroom is saying ZY is deliberately telling you what she knows are falsehoods. In another portion, defense counsel said, you don't have someone on the witness stand who knows that they are fabricating. You've got someone who believes it happened. So when you have somebody who is honestly mistaken because they adopted a false belief, that is the opposite of being dishonest. They are being honest, but they are wrong. They are, their statements are false, but they are not knowingly telling a lie. And that was the defense theory here. And so to equate suggestibility with dishonesty, I think, is a very slippery slope. Because suggestibility, I think we all know that kids are prone or vulnerable to suggestion by adults. Does that make every child a person of dishonest character? Obviously, it does not. Those are two different things. And so ZY here was portrayed as an honest person who came into the courtroom laboring under false beliefs that had been imposed on her by her mother in particular and by the adults around her. And so in order to, I think, I know that X line is out there, but really in order to follow X line, that's the reasoning that you'd have to use. You'd have to say that every child who is suggestible is also dishonest. And that's not what Miller says. It's not what any of the authorities say. And so X line, I think, I would invite this court to follow all of the other authorities, the weight of authority that I've cited, and to not follow X-line in this regard.
Mr. Sweben, let me follow up on the Miller case, which you are relying on, and I know it was announced after X-line. Now, in Miller, what it's discussing is you need something more than just, you know, attack on inconsistent statements, either inherently or another witness contradicting. And so I think it is attempting to discuss what is something more than. And I think that you are attempting to do the same thing. And you're saying X-line is an outlier, but Miller is also relying on Wheatley, and Wheatley relies on X-line. So I'm having a little bit of difficulty here seeing that Miller is not following X-line's distinction. And so can you discuss that a little bit? Because I think it's incorporating it, and if you can tell me why it's not.
I don't think it's incorporating X-line's holding that suggestibility is the same as dishonesty. And that's really what's at issue here in this case. It may be relying on it, and I don't recall the exact quote that the court's referring to, but maybe relying on Wheatley for a more general statement that something more than inconsistencies or attack on inconsistencies is required. But I don't think it's specifically adopting the holding that when you argue that somebody is suggestible or has adopted a false belief, that is the same as dishonesty. The much later case of People versus Hall adopts the formulation from Wright and Gold, which says character evidence bears no specific link to the facts or parties in the case. And that, I think, is the more modern view than the X-line view.
Can you hold on just a minute, counsel? We don't have the clock running. Zoibella. So do we have an estimate of how much time Mr. Zoibella has used?
We have about 5 minutes left.
At least my clock isn't.
No, mine's not either.
5 minutes and 12 seconds.
Thank you. Okay.
The harmfulness of this evidence, I think, is evident in the prosecution's closing argument, where they specifically rely on this character evidence. They say nobody's saying ZY is a liar. These people came in and said she's a truth teller. She always tells the truth, and that's why you should convict. And so it was extremely harmful, the admission of this evidence. And that harmfulness was compounded by the evidence from Ms. McDonald. And I want to talk about that for just a minute, and hopefully save just 2 minutes for rebuttal. Ms. McDonald improperly usurped the jury's function of assessing ZY's credibility. And two out of the four comments that I talk about weren't talking about children in general, as the prosecution talked about in the answer brief. They were talking about ZY in particular. She said, the question was, and if you were to interview ZY again about these incidents, would you expect perfect consistency? And she said no, and she explained why, and what she did was she then excused, and this case was built on inconsistencies, but she offered an expert opinion that allowed the jury to excuse the inconsistencies of ZY's statement. She did the same thing with ZY's lack of detail. The question was, and as ZY in the interview is relating to you what's happening or has happened to her, she indicates it happened the same way every time. Is that common or uncommon in your training and experience? So again, this was a comment specifically on ZY's credibility. She had two other comments about children in general that I talk about in the brief, that it's relatively common to have inconsistencies, that a child is telling the truth when he or she corrects the interviewer. But as we know from Snook and Wittrein, comments on children in general can constitute and do constitute improper comments on the credibility of the child. And so I think what we have is really a pervasive set of evidence that usurped the jury's function of assessing credibility, and that's why reversal is required. If the court doesn't have any questions right now, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. And Bailiff, how much time is remaining?
2 minutes, 43 seconds.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Good afternoon. My name is Molly McNabb, and it is my honor to represent the people in this case. I'd like to turn first to the testimony of the victim's character for truthfulness, which defense counsel spent most of the time on here. As we know under Rule 608A, evidence of a witness's character for truthfulness is admissible after that witness's character has been attacked. And as Judge Terry pointed out, this is a determination based on a case-by-case evaluation and is based on the totality of the circumstances at trial. Further, given the broad discretion that trial courts have over admissibility of evidence, the trial court's determination that the character of that witness has been attacked should be affirmed so long as there is record support for it. And really what this comes down to is there are two kinds of cases here which the court and defense counsel were discussing. First, you have cases like Miller and Hall, which deal exclusively with contradictory testimony and impeachment of specific statements made at trial or specific statements made prior to trial. And in those cases, the court had found that impeachment was not enough to constitute an attack on the character for truthfulness and thus does not open the door under Rule 608. However, we have other cases like X-Line that encompass more than just impeachment at trial. And X-Line applies the same law that Miller and Hall relied upon. It's not different law at all. And contrary to defense counsel's position, X-Line is consistent legally with all of the cases prior to and after its opinion was issued.
How do you respond to Mr. Zweibel's comment that it's inconsistent with the interpretation of the federal rule?
Well, The interpretation of the federal rule would be important here if this were an issue of first impression, or if there were inconsistencies in applying the rule. But we have Colorado case law that is consistent and is based on Colorado Rule of Evidence 608. So there's really no need to turn to the federal rule, although it is the same. Really, we have the body of law that we need here in Colorado, like Exline, like Miller, like Hall, that are all consistent and all apply Rule 608 in the same way. And really what differentiates those two sets of cases is the facts. Because unlike Miller and Hall, where it was a specific set of testimony that was impeachable, Exline dealt with three things that we have in this case: the theory of defense, the opening statement, and the cross-examination of the victim. It's true that if the cross-examination of the victim included impeachment, that alone here would not have been enough. But we don't just have the cross-examination of the victim. The defendant's entire theory of defense was that the victim was lying. And although that word wasn't used at trial, there's no need for the magic word to be used. And we can look to cases like Hall to see the flip side of the same coin. In that case, the use of the word sincere was deemed to be the same as truthfulness. And here we just have the use of the words for untruthfulness, which are synonyms or euphemisms for the words used in Rule 608. So even though the specific word of untruthful was not testified to by a witness in regards to the victim, the defendant still opened the door based on the words that were used.
Well, could I stop you for just a minute?
Go ahead.
This is just why Bell pointed out that defense counsel specifically said in closing argument, no one in this case is saying that ZY is deliberately coming into this courtroom and telling you what she knows are falsehoods.
And I think,
I mean, that sounds different than what you were just saying.
Well, I think that there's two points. There are two responses I have to that question, Your Honor. First, I would point out that in defendant's opening statement, which would be temporally what would open the door to the statements made during trial, defense counsel said at the very beginning of the opening statement that, and it is because of this series of events that he had just described, that we are here today to test the veracity of what the victim is now saying occurred over the years.
But I think the difference being the trouble I'm having with your position is this is character. This is testimony about the character, not about not understanding or even telling a lie on one occasion. This is a character for truthfulness.
Right. And I think it's also important to, the second part to my answer of your question would be about the defendant is trying to make a fine distinction between sort of the motivation for the victim's lying. And that's not part of the rule. The victim doesn't have to be morally culpable for her lies in order to trigger 608. The rule is that the character for truthfulness has been challenged. And here, the defendant, although he's arguing that she was falsely accusing the defendant because the mother had coached her or because the mother had compelled her to lie for some reason, doesn't change the fact that the theory of defense is still that the victim is lying. Just because there's a motivation behind the lying or that she's not necessarily lying on purpose doesn't change the fact that it's calling into question her credibility, her character evidence, or excuse me, her character for truthfulness.
Well, Ms. McDowell, let me follow up on that then. So we're looking at a distinction between just mere credibility, which can be inconsistencies on this occasion of a reporting of these allegations. And then we can look on the other hand of somebody's character or a trait. And what we're talking about now is a motivation on a specific occasion. So does the motivation on a specific occasion fall into the trait category, or does it fall into a credibility on this occasion? Because I don't think there's a disagreement it has to do with this occasion only, and not on the broader view of is she just motivated to tell untruths about people as a character trait. But where does it fall? Because we do know that mere inconsistencies on a specific occasion are not enough. You need something more than, and that's the words that Miller uses, relying on Wheatley.
And is this something more than motivation?
I think it is. And the reason is because we don't just see this in the cross-examination of the victim, where we would normally see that specific statement that would go to the credibility. But the defendant, through opening statement, through the theory of defense, through the cross-examination, and through really permeated the trial, was this idea that the victim had been lying and sort of percolating this story for years. This wasn't just one instance, one statement. You know, a lot of these cases deal with a specific fact relating to the case. This is a much broader categorization of the victim as a long-term manufacturer of a story. And that, as we see in X-Line, opens the door for character witness, for character testimony of truthfulness. And I would also point out that this evidence is harmless. The victim testified, and she was vigorously cross-examined by defense counsel. She gave a full account of the sexual assaults, and she gave the jury an opportunity for it itself to determine her credibility. This testimony, frankly, it was also underwhelming. You put grandmothers on the stand to testify about their own granddaughter's credibility. It'd be far more shocking had they said, no, we don't believe a word she says. And defense counsel pointed this out in closing argument and made the point that it's like asking your own mother about their child. And then he went on to say that, ladies and gentlemen, have you ever met a single teenager that was not willing to fabricate to a person in a position of authority? All teenagers are willing to fabricate. So even if this was harm, or even if this was error, it wasn't harmless given the fact that defense counsel pointed out that this was definitely a biased witness when it came to the victim's credibility. Additionally, the jury was properly instructed. They were specifically referred back to that instruction by both counsel in closing argument. And if defense counsel pointed out in his argument that the defendant is essentially arguing that the victim was truthful. She was telling what she thought was true. So if that's the case, then this must have been harmless because it was actually bolstering the victim or the defendant's theory of defense, should we actually believe that his theory of defense was that she was truthful in this situation. So for those reasons, it is not only not error, and it also, if it was error, it would be harmless error. If there's no further questions on that issue, we'll turn briefly to the issue of the expert testimony regarding the victim's behavior. The case law on this issue is consistent, and when it's applied to this case, we find that there is no error. Under Rule 702, we know that experts are allowed to testify to specialized knowledge that would assist the jury in understanding the evidence or certain facts in the case. And that testimony can include specific behaviors that are unique to children who have been victimized, or victims' behaviors, characteristics during forensic interviews. And we also know from this court's recent decision in Bridges that an expert may also help the jury to determine make its own credibility determination by describing general indicia of coaching and untruthfulness of interviewees. The problem, as Bridges points out, is that ultimate question. The jury can be presented with premises. Here's what happens. Here's what we see as general behavior characteristics based on my experience and knowledge. Here's what we see in this victim that you just watched the interview of. What they can't be asked is that ultimate conclusion, and we don't have that question here. So it's consistent with the previous case law, and specifically with Bridges, that the jury can be presented with these premises and then asked to draw their own conclusion, so long as the expert doesn't testify by themselves. And that's exactly what happened here. And again, I would make the same arguments regarding harmlessness, that the jury was properly instructed, that the victim was vigorously cross-examined, and that the jury actually saw this forensic interview and presumably watched it again during deliberations. So we know that they were able to make their own determination and answer that final question, which the expert was not asked, about the victim's credibility during that interview.
Well, Ms. McNabb, defense counsel asserts that the expert said, well, if a child corrects me during an interview, that means they're telling me what actually happened. And apparently this child corrected her during the interview. And so he's saying that essentially is the same thing as commenting on this child, and I'd just like to hear your response.
Exactly, and you know, that goes to, again, like I was describing, the two premises. You can say, what I generally see in victims of sexual assault is X, Y, and Z. And then you can show a video of the victim doing X, Y, and Z and have an expert testify in the interview, I saw X, Y, and Z. But the question is whether the expert was asked that final question of, is the victim truthful in your given your experience and expertise? And the expert wasn't asked that question here. And so yes, and as defense counsel points out in his reply brief, it's a leap that is easy to make, and that's true. But that's the case law, and that's exactly what Bridges said, and that's what we have here, is that you can put those two premises in front of the jury and ask them to make the leap themselves, so long as the expert doesn't testify about that final conclusion.
And is this distinguishable from, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's the Snook case where it says children tend to fabricate and that was found to be improper?
Tend not to fabricate?
Or tend not to, I'm sorry, children tend not to fabricate.
I would say that this is distinguishable because here we don't have that specific question, and we don't have that specific testimony about from the expert about this victim's ability to fabricate. And so it's not the ultimate issue that is the question for the jury, reserved solely for the jury.
Okay.
If there are no further questions, I would respectfully request that this court affirm the conviction and sentence.
Thank you, counsel. Rebuttal?
Thank you, Alice. Your Honor, listening to Ms. McNabb, it occurs to me that the place where we really want to draw the line with regard to character evidence is whether the attack on credibility is case-specific. The question is the jury being asked to assess the reliability of this testimony, or is the jury being asked to assess the character and general qualities of the person? And here they were being asked, the defense counsel, as Judge Furman pointed out, specifically disclaimed saying that ZY was lying. The word lying was never used. That's only used by the prosecution. It was never used by the defense. The defense counsel in opening statement, as Ms. McNabb points out, asked the jury to test the veracity of what ZY was saying. In other words, these statements, not that ZY is a dishonest person, and you, of course, can be completely honest and yet mistaken. And so that, I think, is the distinction that should be drawn. With regard to the second issue, just very briefly, I understand the Attorney General's argument that a witness, an expert witness, can comment on general characteristics of a child, but the testimony here heard in two fashions. One is that the testimony specifically talked about CY, as I quoted those two instances in my first argument here today. And then it asked the jury to assess credibility of children in general, as they did in the Snook case, I think it was that Judge Lichtenstein pointed out. And so they really hit both kinds of errors here. And so for those reasons and for all the reasons in the brief, I will ask the court to reverse the convictions here.
Thank you to both counsel for your excellent briefing and arguments. We really appreciate them. The case will now stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.